Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Deep down in Louisiana, close to New Orleans, way back up in the woods among the evergreens, there stood a log cabin made of earth and wood, where lived a country boy named Johnny B. Good, who never ever learned to read or write so well, but he could play a guitar just like a ringing a bell.
Yeah, it's Chuck Berry's Johnny B. Good, which according to Rolling Stone was the first rock and roll hit about rock and roll stardom, and it came out in 1958, when Chuck Berry was rock and roll's most consistent hit maker after Elvis Presley. And now we continue with our series, The Eights, A Brief History of the Culture War, Decade by Decade Since World War II. Today we arrive in 1958. You know, it wasn't yet the 60s, but the seeds were there. The civil rights movement was in full swing. We'll do a whole segment on that tomorrow with Mary Frances Berry. But there wasn't yet a counterculture per se. There weren't hippies yet or much attention to feminist or environmental causes, a little bit. But there were beatniks in 1958 suggesting stirrings of alienation with 1950s mainstream culture. Homosexuality was illegal in, I think, every state. But the Supreme Court ruled in 1958 that a magazine describing gay relationships was not in and of itself obscenity under the law. A lower court had ruled that it was. The court also took a stand against school segregation in the South by ruling that Brown versus Board of Education, and really every Supreme Court decision, applies to state governments, not just the federal one. That was groundbreaking in 1958. There was no legal birth control pill yet, but doctors were prescribing a newly approved drug called Enovid, which was officially to treat menstrual disorders. They were prescribing them to women who really used it as contraception. Here's Margaret Sanger, the birth control activist, on the early use of the pill. She speaks here in 57 on the Mike Wallace Show.
There was a certain satisfaction in doing something that was going to alleviate the sufferings of women in particular, and I was quite a feminist at the time.
Mm-hmm, obviously.
And, yes, and I naturally didn't want to see women take all the suffering of childbearing and of pregnancies. So it was a pleasure in a sense to think that you were striking at an archaic law, which it was. Mm-hmm. It was put on the statute books by Anthony Comstock some years ago, and no one had stood up against it. No one had tried to change the laws. And at that time, not even a doctor had a right to use the United States mails and common carriers for books, for learning, for anything that he had to do with this question. It was considered obscene.
Margaret Sanger, I guess that was a later clip. It sounds like she was looking back, but on what was going on in 1958. And of course, the backlash came quickly and on some level continues to this day. NASA was established in 1958. So was the John Birch Society. The first microchip was developed, and Alaska became a state. In 1948, Ronald Reagan, let me say that better. In 1948, Ronald Reagan was president of the Screen Actors Guild. By 1958, he was giving speeches for GE across the country that were anti-organized labor. Here's a short excerpt from a radio interview that Reagan did in 1958, in which he extolled the virtues of GE management and accused labor leaders of waging class warfare.
There are still those in labor who want to keep a contest, a battle, a
don't
class
you think
war.
This, don't you think this is labor's growing pains, actually?
Yes. Yes, I think this is the first time they have ever, these recent years, felt the and had the strength they now have, and I think they're still coming out of now again, remember, I'm speaking of isolated individuals.
Oh, of course, of course.
There's still a tendency to say, well, now is our chance, you know, let's
sure.
get even.
Yeah.
And they've got to outgrow this. They've got to realize that there's no room for this anymore.
So that was Reagan in 58. In 1958, 22 years before being elected president, and immediately firing the Federal Air Traffic Controllers Union, busting the union. But also in 1958, Senator John F. Kennedy, just 2 years from being elected president, published a book called A Nation of Immigrants. Imagine a young presidential hopeful publishing such a thing today. But here he is in 1963, echoing the theme of that book, when he spoke to the 50th anniversary meeting of the Anti-Defamation League.
America was to be the great experiment, a testing ground for political liberty, a model for democratic government. And although the first task was to mold a nation on these principles, here in this continent, we would also lead the fight against tyranny in all continents. This is a great inheritance. It is a proud privilege to be a citizen of the great republic, to realize that we are the descendants of 40 million people who left other countries, other familiar scenes, to come here to the United States to build a new life, to make a new opportunity for themselves and their children. I think it is not a burden, but a privilege to have the chance to share that great concept among all of our people, to make this really, as it was for them, a new world for us, and indeed for all those who look to us. That is what this organization has stood for 50 years. That's what this country has stood for 200 years. And that's what this country will continue to stand for. Thank you.
So President Kennedy, and again in 58, he had published a short book called A Nation of Immigrants. He was working on a longer version when he was killed in 63, and it was published posthumously. By the way, as an addendum to that, the Berlin Wall had gone up in 61, and through the lens of today's wall debate, it's kind of eerie to hear Kennedy as president talk about the meaning of a wall to families.
While the wall is the most obvious and vivid demonstration of the failures of the communist system, for all the world to see, we take no satisfaction in it, for it is, as your mayor has said, an offense not only against history, but an offense against humanity, separating families, dividing husbands and wives and brothers and sisters, and dividing a people who wish to be joined together.
And on that note, we welcome our first 1958 guest, Fred Kaplan, who you may know as Slate's War Stories columnist. He's been on here many times in that context, but he's also the author of a book from a few years ago called 1959, The Year Everything Changed. We figured 1959 is within our margin of error. So, hi, Fred. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good to be here.
And listeners, calling all beatniks. Seriously, who among you is old enough to remember being an adult in 1958? Call us and contribute a little oral history, will you? Share a memory of what America or New York felt like to you then, culturally or intellectually or politically. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And I mean calling all beatniks. Literally, is anyone listening right now who would have identified yourself as a beatnik or a member of the beat generation in 1958? 212-433-WNYC. Is there a woman listening right now who is using the pill for birth control in 1958 before it was approved for such use? Is there a gay or lesbian listener who remembers what it was like to be a gay person in America in 1958 when it was still against the law? Do you remember the Supreme Court's Roth decision that we referred to, allowing One magazine, it was called One, to be distributed and not banned or restricted under obscenity laws? 212-433-9692, or anything anyone wants to say about 1958 as a prelude or a year of kindling before the culture wars really break out? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. So Fred Kaplan, what were the beats, and when did they first become a thing?
Well, the beats, this is something that makes it distinctive about the late 50s versus the 60s. The transformations and nascent revolutions of the late 50s, which we can talk about in some detail, these were not the product of the baby boomers, people like me. I was born in 1954, right in the middle of the baby boomer. These were people who grew up during World War II, some of them during the Depression, emerged from World War II with great hopes about the new future, and we're disappointed or disenchanted that the world really hadn't changed that much, and we're rebelling against that. This was, you know, I was 5 years old. I was 4 years old in 1958. I wasn't ready to go spawning campus revolts. Yeah. But they took, the people who did later, took their inspiration, some of them quite knowingly, from things that people were saying and doing and writing in the late 50s.
Tell me more about the source of the rebellion, as you understand it from your research and from people. For white people in this country, and again, we'll deal with the civil rights movement of 1958 in a full segment tomorrow with Mary Frances Berry, but for white Americans, the 50s were supposed to be this mythical golden era of family and prosperity. Of course, the Cold War was going on, but domestically, when Trump says, make America great again, it's sort of the 1950s when he thinks America was great the first time.
Right.
So what were the Beats rebelling against?
Well, there was this undercurrent. If you go back and read things at the time, that this great rebellion against complacency. You had Eisenhower, who at the time was the oldest president that there was, and he looked like your grandfather. You know, he had a heart attack and a stroke. There was a calcified political establishment. And yet at the same time, a key moment that I start my book with this, it happened on January 2nd of 59, was that the Russians launched a rocket called the Lunik, also called Mishta, which meant dream. And this was the first rocket that broke through the gravitational pull of the Earth and started rotating around the sun like a planet. Now, this was made a big deal. Time magazine, which was quite hyperbolic in its day, they referred to this as a turning point in the multi-billion-year history of the universe, because for the first time, a creature of the solar system had devised a technology to break free of the gravitational pull of its planet. And so I see what was going on is lots of gravitational pulls being broken through. There was the rise of what happened in the late 50s, the end of obscenity laws in literature. The microchip, the development of the space race. In 58, there was the first jet plane that was transatlantic flight from New York to Paris.
Huh.
That was a new thing. So the world was expanding. Horizons were expanding. Barriers were being broken down. This was very visible and made a big deal of in society, in culture. And yet the political system, what was still quite entrenched in its old ways. And the Beatniks actually were not very political. The Beatniks were dropping out of society. That was their solution. And there were some people like C. Wright Mills, who wrote The Power Elite, and which had a great influence on the New Left. In fact, in 59, he wrote an essay about called The New Left. He was talking about re-engagement in a new kind of way. So that's sort of where this came from.
Let's take a phone call. Joyce in Manhattan. Yeah. You're on WNYC. Hi, Joyce.
Hi.
Hello.
So you have some memories. Where were you in 1958?
I was in New York City. I was Jack Kerouac's girlfriend.
Oh,
really?
Of course.
Yeah. And I knew Allen Ginsberg very well. I was 22 in 1958.
You wrote a book about this, I believe, right?
Yes, I wrote a book called Minor Characters.
Yeah.
So of course, there's so much we could ask you, but as sort of a...
She should be the guest.
You could stay on for the rest of the segment if you want. But as sort of a prelude to the culture wars, did you feel like you were part of something that was rejecting something or setting yourself up in opposition to something or some people in the United States as a self-identified
beat? I felt I was at a transformative moment in American culture. I regard the coming of the Beat Generation as the event that set off the culture wars. It was the very start of it. There really was a, you know, at least among a certain group of people, there was a very, you know, dramatic shift in mores.
Over what? What was important to you at that time?
At that time, as a young woman, sexual liberation was very important to me. There was a very repressed attitude around sex at the time, and I wanted to be a writer, and women were sort of shut out from all kinds of different experiences. I went to Barnard College, which was an all women's college, and still is.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a writing class where the professor basically told us that if we wanted to be writers, because we were women, there was no hope for us because we would never have the experiences that men could have, and therefore what we wrote about our pathetic little lives would not be worth reading. I mean, that was a message we got in a women's college.
You were told that as a college student.
As a college student at Barnard. The previous year, I'd had another professor of writing who would write on my composition, who wrote on one of my essays, quite the little existentialist, aren't we? You know, that kind of thing.
So cute.
It was
darling. At that time, it was a very difficult time for women because women were supposed to go to the... had a lot of pressure for women to go the traditional route. You went to college. It was often said you went to college to get your MRS degree, and women married early. Most of them didn't work. If you wanted to leave home and get your own apartment and support yourself, you were considered probably a bad woman because everybody knew what you'd be up to in that apartment of your own. If you wanted a job, well, I really wanted to leave home, and I went to an employment agency, a week before Barnard ended, and I said, I want a job that starts June 1st, and I got one. Actually, quite a good job for a literary agency, but I was only paid $50 a week. And,
Are you comfortable... staying on and listening to a 45-second clip of your old boyfriend and reacting to it?
Of course.
So this is Beat Generation writer Jack Kerouac on Being a Beatnik with Oscar-winning screenwriter Ben Hecht in 58. Ben Hecht speaks first.
How do people get involved in your group, and is it growing? How does one... How do you qualify as a beat fellow?
It's not a bohemian generation. It's like the Lost Generation. It contains millions of people. There were millions of bathtub gins and flappers and raccoon coats.
Yeah.
Now there are millions of black slacks and ponytails. And
you're ahead of those.
No, I'm saying the beat generation, the bohemian has always been with us, even in the days of Walt Whitman.
That's right.
And there's only a few thousand bohemians ever.
But usually the bohemian or the beat or the lost generation came after a war, and you boys seem to have beat the gun. Are you boys afraid of the next war, worried about it? Do you look forward?
I don't think there'll be one.
Why not?
Because things are in good hands.
So that surprised me, Joyce, when I heard that, for a rebellious sort as Jack Kerouac, saying, well, it's the height of the Cold War, there's not going to be... another war because things are in good hands.
I know. Well, Allen Ginsberg was much more evolved politically than Jack was. The Beat Generation really got its start in the in the years right after the Second World War and in the whole sort of post-war scene. There were a lot of disaffected young veterans among the circle that Jack and Alan moved in, and that was the start of the talking about the Beat Generation. Sort of back then, there was sort of a lag in understanding where Jack's famous novel On the Road falls, because although he wrote it in 1951, it wasn't published until 1957, and that proved to be the perfect moment for it to come out, because my generation, we had all been labeled the silent generation, and we were supposed to be very passive and conformist. We were fed up to the teeth with being the silent generation. And
go.
Here was something new that seemed to define us in a way that we preferred. So, all kinds of people eagerly seized on to this, including many women. You know, there's often now, like, feminists criticize Kerouac for being sexist. Lots of young women glommed on to the message in On the Road, because this was a book saying, open yourself up, have all kinds of experiences.
Joyce, I got to run, but you've given us so much time. I want to at least make sure that we say the name of your book, if maybe it's still available. It was Minor Characters, right?
Minor Characters. It won a National Book Critics Circle Award in 1983, and it's been in print ever since.
Yes, a National Book Critics Circle Award for the memoir, Minor Characters. Joyce Johnson, thank you so much for calling in.
Okay, thank you.
Fred Kaplan?
So, you know, Kerouac, when he said we're in good hands, he was actually different from most of his contemporaries. And in fact, later he became quite right-wing.
Right-wing.
Yeah. But, you know, another root of this whole thing, Mailer, in an essay called The White Negro, which he wrote in 57 and which was published in a book in 59, he started it. He said, probably we will never be able to determine the psychic havoc of the concentration camps and the atom bomb upon the unconscious mind of almost everyone alive in these years. And he said that a new type of person, he called the American existentialist, a new kind of person. He goes, if the fate of 20th century man is to live with death from adolescence to premature senescence, the only life-giving answer is to live with death as immediate danger, to divorce oneself from society, to exist without roots, to set out on that uncharted journey into the rebellious imperatives of the self. Hmm. So that was also one of the roots of hipsterism, the beat generation, that sort of thing. Kerouac, in an interview with the Times in the early 50s, he said, man, this is a beat generation. And that's where it came from. Yeah, Joyce was right. They were beat. It was a modern day version of the lost generation.
We're in our series, The Eights, A Brief History of the Culture Wars. We're in 1958 with Fred Kaplan, author of the book, 1959. You know, we don't always hit our target exactly. And we'll continue in a minute.
I used to play around with hearts, hasten at my call. But when I met that little girl, I knew that I would fall for a little fool. Oh yeah, I was a fool.
Billboard's first Hot 100 hit, Poor Little Fool by Ricky Nelson. So, listeners, if this music sounds like something you can easily process, it was not in 1958. That was not la-di-da, la-di-da, 1-4-5 changes jazz, right? That was Ornette Coleman in around then. I'll look up the exact year. I think that might have been 59.
Yeah.
Fred Kaplan, who wrote a book, 1959, here in our series, The Eights, A Brief History of the Culture War, Decade by Decade. And you're a big jazz fan. You write about jazz. So this, we played that, being audio, as kind of a symbol of how things were breaking out of their traditional creative chains, right?
Ornette Coleman was breaking down chord structures as the basic unit of jazz. And here's the thing, this will be very hard to believe now, but Ornette Coleman, he came to New York. He was a product of L.A., but he came to New York in 59, and this was an enormous deal. I don't mean just among the coterie of jazz fans. This was huge. He played at a club called the Five Spot, which was in the Bowery, which is not what the Bowery is today. people from uptown came, Leonard Bernstein. It was a socially big deal to come. He was in Time magazine. He got a guest column in the New York Post. There were cartoons about it in the New Yorker. This was a big, big deal. Now, why? My point isn't that, you know, Ornette Coleman saw, you know, the rocket launch and said, I'm going to do something different. No, he'd been doing it for quite a while. But what was going on in the late 50s broadly, socially, scientifically, it gave people an appetite for new things. You know, John Kennedy was advertising himself as a man born in this century. He was making a big deal, youth as a virtue. This was a completely new thing in presidential politics. So it was the excitement of the new. That's what Ornette Coleman represents.
So Ornette Coleman was going on and Ricky Nelson was going on at the same time.
Well, you know, there's always a parallel path.
La Cotessa, you're on WNYC. Hello, did I say your name right?
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you. Yes, I worked at Vesuvio's, the beatnik bar owned by Henri Lenoir that was just across the alley from City Lights. And
If you made
$10 a night in a six-hour shift, you were really lucky on tips. It was a different time, and it was good. I waited on Norman Mailer and Ferlinghetti, and it was an artist's... Artists were welcome of every shape and size.
Silvio's in San Francisco.
Vesuvio's, on the alley just... second away from City Lights.
What was the scene like? What do you remember? What was important?
Well, friends would come in and I'd serve them drinks. I mean, a beer was 15 cents, a martini was 50 cents. And it was sort of like, it was family. It was family. And friends wandered in and different people wandered in, and Henri Lenoir was a true bohemian. He wore a beret. He was born in Switzerland. He spoke French, and he was a gentleman of the first order, as was Ferlinghetti.
Thank you very much. Adrian in the East Village, you're on WNYC. Hi, Adrian.
Oh, hi. I came to New York in 1959 at age 17. And unlike most people at the time, I was out. I never was in the closet. And there were gay beatniks, but they had to keep it cool. Their gathering place was called the San Remo. It was down on Bleecker, and I can't remember the corner. But they were very closeted, and I found it very suffocating to be around them. But there were so many subgroups of gays at the time. There were a very rich group uptown that would throw these fabulous parties. And in the village, there were just three bars. And one bar I would go to in the Upper West Side called the May We was a dance bar. And when the lights went on, they would flash. When the police came, they would flash lights. So you would just have to, you know, separate from your partner. And the police were very abusive on many occasions. You know, you'd be walking down. If there was a cluster of people, they'd break you up. You know, they'd hit their billy clubs against the lamp post and yell at you and say nasty things. And of course, most straight people were so condescending of gays. They were like, it was like, we pity you if you were out. Or
had contempt, right?
I became a feminist very early on because I related my experience to that of women. And I still, you know, see how there was a relationship. But, and it was the beginning of the big gay sexual revolution, which for me at 17 was wonderful.
Adrian, thank you so much for sharing your memory. Fred, we're just about out of time, but I want to make sure to get to one other thing with you, because we're talking about the Beats and the early stirrings, like with Adrian, of gay liberation. On the right, the John Birch Society was founded in 1958 by Robert Welch, who had been president of the National Association of Manufacturers. He was a Joe McCarthy supporter and believed communists had infiltrated the top echelons of the United States government. And from what I've read, he even suspected President Eisenhower. And the conservative icon William Buckley, a few years later, would denounce the Birchers as radical fringe, but in 58, he supported them with Inc. and National Review. What kind of conservative alienation might the John Birch Society have been responding to by forming in 1958? that also sets up the history of the culture war that we'll continue to trace in subsequent segments?
Well, you know, the word reactionary, what's the root of that? It's reacting. These kind of movements tend to rise in reaction to things going on in society that make them feel insecure, that make them feel like the world is collapsing, as indeed the world was collapsing in a certain sense. Now, they too had their roots. I mean, out of Joe McCarthy in the early 50s, that there have always been far right wing groups dating back to the Comstock movement, which Margaret Sanger referred to. But yeah, you know, there is never any perfectly straight line or perfectly darting upward line in social progress. That there's always resistance. There's always reaction.
Well, we want to thank Fred Kaplan, who, again, you know, we don't always get it right, but we come close. His book is called 1959, The Year Everything Changed. Thank you so much for coming in.
Sure.
And more 1958 tomorrow with Mary Frances Berry, former chair of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. The commission was working on its very first report in 1958. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.